Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies, a podcast channel on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I get the pleasure of speaking with Anway Mukhopadhyay, who is assistant professor at the Department of Humanities and Social Sciences at the India Institute of Technology. We're speaking about a really interesting 2020 Palgrave publication, The Authority of Female Speech in Indian Goddess Traditions, Devi and Womansplaining. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Raj. Thank you very much. It's very nice to talk to you once again. It's more than 1 year, right? We last talked about my Routledge book. So that was in 2019. Yeah.
So how did you publish two books in such relatively close succession for the academic world?
Yeah, actually, Raj, I mean, whenever I start writing a book, I mean, it's not like, embarking on the journey in an academic way only. It's like some kind of flash, some kind of inspiration that I get. In fact, while I was in Varanasi, I got that flash, which took the shape of the earlier book, the Routledge book. And as far as this book is concerned, I think it was in 2018 itself that I began to think in this line, how to think about the role of the goddess as an instructor rather than as the demon slayer. More often than not, in contemporary India, we tend to think about Shakti in terms of this demon slaying function. But what about the role of the goddess as a teacher? And in fact, it was for a very long period of time that I had been thinking about the Devi Gitas. I read a lot of these Devi Gitas, and I thought that some kind of generic, new generic genealogy of these Devi Gitas could be established. For instance, if you think about the Devi Gitas or the Shakta Gitas that we find in various Puranas. For instance, there is one in the Kudma Purana, there is one in the Mahabhagavata Upa Purana, there is one in the Devi Bhagavata Purana, and the Devi Bhagavata Purana, Devi Gita, is the most celebrated one. But I was also thinking about the Vidya Gita that is there in the Tripura Rahasya. And it occurred to me that one could probably do something on these Devi Gitas, and one could probably talk about them as a cluster of texts. That was not just inspired by the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, but that was rather, a unique tradition within Shaktism itself. Of course, there is an influence of the Upanishads, the Srimad Bhagavad Gita from the Mahabharata, that's obvious. But still, it appears that there is some kind of originality as far as this Shakta tradition of the Devi Gitas is concerned. And I wanted to work on them. At first, I thought of translating these texts either into Bengali, which is my mother tongue, or into English. But then it occurred to me that I could probably think about them critically and not just, in terms of doing some kind of translation. And then I began to think about recontextualizing these texts in the contemporary world. And then, I came up with this concept of mansplaining and womansplaining later on. And it occurred to me that in India, you have this very unique alternative tradition, which might be called the tradition of womansplaining, but that is not just a kind of, feminization of, say, mansplaining. That's something else, something different. So that's how I began to think about these issues. And then I thought that I shouldn't just work with the Devi Gitas, but I should try to recontextualize them within a larger tradition where I have come across the figure of the Devi as a powerful speaker, as a speaker who has some authority, not some authority, in fact, who has the greatest authority. And her speech is the speech of the, the greatest spiritual illuminator, because she is, as it were, the supreme guru. And then I began to think about constructing a different kind of genealogical paradigm. And here, in fact, my training as a student of literature came to some use. Because whenever we talk about literary genealogies or literary historiography, we actually talk about the different kinds of genealogical recontextualization within which you can place certain texts. So I thought that I should try to build up a new kind of genealogy, thematically, of course, which is millennia old. I mean, if you look at this tradition, you will find that it's at least as old as the Rig Veda, because you have the Devi Sukta there. And in a way, you may say that in the Devi Sukta too, the goddess is a speaker, not just a speaker, but also a teacher in a way, because she is revealing her own self. And this self-revelation is a trope which occurs time and again in the later Hindu texts, in the Puranas, and of course in the Tantras. But even without getting into the Tantras, we can probably chart out a very vast arena where the goddess appears to be a powerful speaker, an authoritative speaker. And it was not just that. What is interesting is that this figure of the goddess as an authoritative speaker also has her patient male listeners. And this is very interesting, because when we talk about speaking or say silence, whatever, particularly in the domain of gender studies, we often tend to forget that the communication circuit is about speaking and listening. It's not just about speaking. I mean, I can speak, but if no one listens to me, then that speech is meaningless. So what about the figure of the listener, particularly the male listener of female speech? That idea intrigued me for a long period of time. And I thought that this kind of tradition could be seen as an alternative tradition that is not just alternative to, say, the Western tradition of mansplaining, but also the Indic tradition of mansplaining. I mean, we can't say that in India we have just a feminist tradition. Even within the goddess traditions, there are a lot of contexts where you have a patriarchal appropriation of, the feminist potential of the goddess tradition, probably. And so the feminist tradition gets, I won't call it a feminist tradition, but nevertheless, the feminist potential of a goddess tradition gets appropriated or, say, overshadowed by the patriarchal, the overarching patriarchal structure within which it is articulated, or it is forced to articulate itself. So that was the idea which I was thinking of. And then I thought that I should try to embark on this new journey of finding out a very new kind of, not exactly finding out, but establishing a very new kind of genealogy of the goddess traditions, where the goddess is primarily a guru, and she is presented not just as a guru, but probably as the guru, so that was the idea which intrigued me.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So two questions for you. You can answer in whichever order. The first one is, what exactly do you mean when you use this term woman-splaining? And the second is, regarding these examples where the goddess is a guru, what examples do you look at in your book?
Yeah, you see, when I think about this concept of woman-splaining, actually there are two problems, and these problems have been highlighted by many scholars of the goddess traditions as far as the Indian traditions are concerned. One problem is that, you can't really say that there is, sort of obvious parallels between the Western feminist tradition and the Indian goddess traditions. That is something which the scholars of the Indian goddess traditions have always strived to make us understand. And that is something which I also acutely understand. I can't say that the Indian goddess traditions are quintessentially feminist. But I also believe very strongly that there are a lot of themes in the Indian goddess traditions which display some kind of feminist potential. And of course, even though the Western feminist tradition and these goddess traditions are not, quote unquote, feminist in the exactly same way, there are nevertheless points of commonality. Probably. And that's why I picked up this concept of woman-splaining. In my book, I actually use the term mansplaining in the sense it's used by Rebecca Solnit. And as far as the concept of woman-splaining is concerned, I have focused on the work of Neil Stephens, where she talks about how woman-splaining is different from mansplaining, and woman-splaining is not about exerting your authority over the others in an oppressive way, but rather it's about sharing of one's experience, and it's a kind of non-oppressive communicative mode, which is not, as I said, just the the feminized version of mansplaining, but rather something different. And according to Stevens, it's something which offers you a different paradigm of communication. And that's why I took up this term, even though I don't argue in my book that whatever we find in the goddess traditions in India can be called woman-splaining in the sense it's, the term is being used in the West. Because as I said, there are a lot of differences as well as similarities between, authoritative female speech in the Western feminist tradition and authoritative female speech in the Indian goddess tradition. So there are differences. For instance, one might argue whether, one might question whether the goddess can be seen as a woman at all. And that is one of the most intriguing questions which I seek to respond to in my book. For instance, I talk about the connections and the parallels between goddesses and women, which are there, which are probably not very obvious always, but more often than not, if you look deeply in these texts, you will find that there are certain connections between the authoritative speech of the goddess and the authoritative female speech in general. So I have argued that there are two ways in which you can draw to the feminist potential of these goddess traditions. One is that you can probably think about the ways in which women today can appropriate, the feminine authority, which is involved in the speeches of the goddess in the Indic traditions. And on the other hand, you can also think about the kind of feminist historiography which can probably be constructed from the direct, most of the times indirect, but sometimes direct too, sort of connections that one might find between the authoritative female speech of the goddess and the probable authority of women in certain historical and geographical contexts in India. For instance, if you think about Biedaki's work on the tantric texts from Assam, I mean, from what is now Assam, the northeastern part of India, she was working on the texts that were produced in the Kamakhya region. But you might find that there are probably, you know, some kind of historical connection too between the figure of a powerful goddess and powerful women. But I also know that this is an issue which is very complex. And I can't just say that the goddess as a powerful female figure is always a prototype for, say, powerful women. That's not always the case. And in fact, in certain cases, you have some kind of tension and sometimes even some overt dichotomy between a powerful figure of the goddess and, on the other hand, disempowered women. So probably the text which is celebrating the power and authority of the goddess is also in a way presenting certain elements of which are anti-feminist in nature, as has also been noticed by Shiver Mackenzie Brown. But what is interesting here, what interested me rather, is that there is a possibility of building up a dialogue between the concepts of, say, mansplaining, womansplaining, the contemporary modes of Western feminism, and the Indic goddess traditions. And that was very important for me, because more often than not, there is a kind of non-dialogic engagement with the goddess traditions, where you find that either some scholars are arguing that these goddess traditions are potentially feminist, or there are some other scholars who are arguing that these are anti-feminist, or, you know, these have nothing to do with feminism at all. So I thought that both of these modes of argument were actually simplistic. For instance, if you say that the goddess is not going to empower women at all, then also I think you are making a simplistic statement and also a reductionist statement. And if you say that the goddess is the panacea for all the problems as far as gender is concerned in contemporary India, then also I think that's going to be a simplistic kind of argument. So I think that what we need to do in this context is that we need to have a very nuanced understanding of, the Indian goddess traditions. We need to begin with the proposition that the goddess traditions should not be excavated only for the sake of finding out something which is feminist in a ready-made way, but rather we should try to look at them, or rather we should try to engage in a dialogue with these goddess traditions from our contemporary vantage point, so that there can be a dialogue, there can be a productive dialogue between our feminist concerns from today's perspective and the Indic goddess traditions, which have foregrounded the authority of female speech in various ways. And it has happened through millennia. For instance, more often than not, there is this misconception that only the tantric dimension of the goddess cultures is truly empowering for women. But if you look closely at the genealogy of authoritative female speech in the Indic goddess traditions, you find that there is some kind of a continuum, even though there are obvious discontinuities as well. But I would argue that there is some kind of continuum where you have a kind of reiterative trope of the authoritative female speech associated with the goddess traditions. Sometimes it comes in the form of, say, female gurus who are revered as living goddesses, as we have seen in the case of Ananda Mahima, or in the case of Sharadama, the wife of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. Or you have the figure of a goddess who is teaching somebody. Okay, for instance, if you take the figure of Uma in the Keno Upanishad, you find that she is actually instructing Indra in the Brahma Vidya. And in the Lakshmi Tantram, you have a similar kind of situation, a similar kind of context where Lakshmi, goddess Lakshmi, who is the great goddess there, she is instructing Indra. Similarly, in the cases of the Devi Gitas, you have the goddess instructing either Himalaya within a domestic setup, or in the case of the Devi Bhagavata Purana, Himalaya and the gods, in a kind of celestial setup. So I think we need to look at, or rather we need to sort of recontextualize all these different goddess texts within this alternative genealogy of, authoritative female speech. So that history, that historical tradition needs to be captured and underlined. And to answer your second question, I would say that writing this book was in a way very difficult for me, because I wanted to engage with texts from different historical periods as far as the Indian goddess traditions are concerned. And that's why I had to work with the Vedic texts, I had to work with the various Upanishads, not just the canonical Upanishads, but also the Shakta Upanishad. And I tried to, sort of establish the connections between these texts. That was, again, a very difficult job. Because when you do that, you are faced with a lot of questions. For instance, one might ask you, what is it exactly which drives you to connect, say, an Upanishadic text with a tantric text, because you might say that the socio-historical context of the genesis of these texts are not similar. That's true, but the point is that when we look at the Hindu tradition, we need to look at it as a living tradition. And it's a very complex tradition which has always expanded itself and accommodated diverse points of view. Besides, it's also a tradition which has always reworked the earlier texts. For instance, as far as my perspective is concerned, I might say that for me, the Devi Bhagavata, or say the later Devi Gitas, are in a way reworking not just the Upanishads and the Gitas in generic terms, that okay, there is an Upanishad which is talking about the abstract absolute, so we are going to talk about the goddess. It's not just that. It's also about reworking certain tropes. For instance, the trope of the goddess as teacher, the trope of the goddess as someone who sort of interrogates male pride in certain cases. And I have discussed that in my book, that it's there in the Tripura Rahasya too, where you have the sages acknowledging that in spite of their intellect, in spite of having a kind of a mammoth intellect, they are not able to comprehend the very subtle truth, the very subtle spiritual truth. So ultimately, it is the goddess in her transcendental form, or rather, in a kind of formless entity. It's in that way that the goddess enlightens them. So, and you have a similar kind of situation in the Nigama texts, in the tantric tradition as well. For instance, there you often find Shiva in the form of Vaidava telling Devi that in spite of having a great knowledge of all these different shastras and darshanas, he's not really able to grasp the ultimate spiritual truth. And then the goddess instructs him. So this book of mine is actually about finding out and establishing these connections between texts, which have more often than not been seen as unrelatable, you know, as texts which are coming out of different socio-historical contexts. Fine, they are coming from different socio-historical contexts. I do acknowledge that. But the point is that there is a connection between them, because we need to understand that the tradition which these texts inhabit, those traditions are actually living traditions, and they are continuously evolving traditions. So that has been my sort of approach to this issue.
So what's at stake here for you? What is the central point you wish to demonstrate with this book?
Yeah. Now, you know, the central point is that, as I said, when you look at the Indian goddess traditions, you need to look at the figure of the goddess as a spiritual enlightener, you know, so as the ultimate spiritual enlightener, as it were. This is one thing. The second thing, as I said, it's also a project of, I can't probably use the term, you know, alternative historiography, because historiography would involve probably a very different kind of methodology from what I have used here. But of course, I wanted to bring to the fore an alternative genealogy of the goddess traditions. So whenever we talk about the goddess traditions, the rise of the Mahadevi and all these things, we tend to focus mainly, on the figure of the goddess as the demoniac. So that is what I wanted to move away from. I wanted to look at the other functions of the goddess in the Indic traditions. And my question was, so where these other functions of the goddess, especially, you know, this function of spiritual education or spiritual enlightenment, this function which also connects the goddess with the archetypes for female gurus in the Hindu traditions, how can we find the impact of these other functions, you know, this kind of educative function of the goddess on men? What was the impact of that on Indian men? So a main focus of this book is how men have transformed the paradigms of masculinity, the conventional paradigms of masculinity, when they have come in contact with these traditions of authoritative female speech. And in order to do this, I tried to, again, establish a certain connections between the mythological texts. For instance, if you think about, the approaches of the different male figures in the Puranas, or say, even in a text like the Tripura Rahasya, where you have the ultimate acknowledgement of the inadequacy of the male intellect, and on the other hand, the celebration of the supreme goddess as the supreme source of spiritual wisdom. So how that leads to some kind of assumption of humility on the part of the male subject, and how this is something which we find again in the tantric traditions. So as far as the works and the tantras are concerned, you have a lot of existing works on these issues. But nevertheless, I found that whenever we talk about the goddess traditions, we mainly tend to talk about the issue of femininity, or say how the goddess is is able or unable to contribute to the discourse of feminism and all these things. But I tried to move away from that and to address this issue from the perspective of masculinity. But, you know, when men are listening to this kind of authoritative female speech of the goddess, I mean, within the Puranic context, or even within the tantric context, what is the impact of that, and what kind of alternative model of masculinity emerges from that? On the other hand, I also had this query: how has this translated into the real life sort of men and women and their sort of attitudes to each other? So for that, I also included, in my book, certain elements which are related to the contemporary Indian society. For instance, I have dealt with one Bengali text in detail, and it is actually a reworking of the trope of, or not exactly trope, the tropos of the Vrigu Pariksha, the test to which the sage Vrigu had put the Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. So that story is deliberately reworked by this Bengali writer, Prosenjit Basu. And this text, Parvati Purana, is actually presented as an alternative kind of mythological text, an alternative kind of Purana, where it is, where the entire story that you find in the mainstream texts is looked at from the Shakta perspective, and the supremacy of the goddess is put forward. And interestingly, there Shiva says that he's a devotee of the goddess, he's a husband, but also a devotee of the goddess. And then Vishnu says that he's also a devotee of the goddess. And ultimately, we find that it becomes a theological text rather than a kind of theological text that declares the supremacy of Vishnu in other contexts. For instance, whenever we think about that particular topos of the Vrigu Pariksha, we find the supremacy of Vishnu being declared over the other gods. And that has some kind of connection with the announcement of the supremacy of Brahmins as well. So in a way, that also leads to some kind of Brahminical hegemony. But in this work, Prasenjit Basu actually demolishes that androcentric kind of theological paradigm. And he also interrogates the kind of Brahmin-centric interpretation of the Vrigu Pariksha that you often have in the mainstream cultures of Hinduism. So these are the texts of which I worked with. I mean, of course, I worked with the main Sanskrit texts, but I also drew on a lot of vernacular texts, because it appeared to me that without referring to these Bengali texts, or say in some cases, certain Hindi texts, I won't be able to relate really the traditional Indian goddess cultures with the contemporary scenario. Because if I have to talk about the contemporary scenario, then I will have to look at the interplay between the Sanskrit texts and the vernacular texts. And that's why this work is very much grounded in the here and the now, as well as in the goddess traditions of India.
So is this a line of thought that you are pursuing? What are you working on now?
Yeah, I am now working on, after this work is finished, I am now thinking about, some other ideas, again, related to the goddess cultures in India. For instance, I'm thinking about a possibility of finding out an Indian model and a kind of Shakta model of existentialism. This idea is there only in a rudimentary form in my mind. I don't know when this idea is going to take shape in a proper way. But nevertheless, I am thinking about this a lot, these days. And when I talk about a Shakta paradigm of existentialism, what I'm trying to look at is that here you have a kind of foregrounding of this feminine force as great nature. Okay. And I think I mean, at this stage, my ideas are not very coherent. So probably, you know, I won't be able to argue in this line in a very coherent way. But at a rudimentary level, what I'm thinking is that in the Western model of existentialism, probably, you know, the agency of nature is seen either it's bracketed off or it's seen as a very problematic thing. And that is something with which probably, you know, with which you can probably connect the Vedantic model of thought as well. But I think when we think about Shakta philosophers or even, you know, certain writers, particularly I'm thinking about Vivekananda, because even though we all know that he was the great Vedantist, there is also this continuous reference to the great cosmic force of Kali in his writings, particularly in his intimate interactions with his friends, with Nivedita, for instance, with Sister Nivedita, and with his Guru Bhais, for instance. So this idea that somehow, you know, even though you try to become completely, you know, independent of nature, somehow you find that there is a kind of para-prakriti or a great nature which has a higher agency. And how do you try to reconcile your desire to get liberated from all binding factors? And how do you reconcile that kind of desire with this subconscious acknowledgement of a higher force, which is feminine in nature? You know, I mean, is a reconciliation possible or is it not? And so I'm trying to look at these tensions, but it's now at the rudimentary stage. So I can't say that, I mean, this this paradigm has been well articulated in my mind here.
Well, that sounds interesting. Sounds very interesting. Perhaps we'll have the chance to speak about that book whenever it is birthed into the world.
Yeah.
We have taken enough of your time for one day, and so we will sign off. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Anwe Mukhopadhyay. His 2020 Palgrave publication, The Authority of Female Speech in Indian Goddess Traditions. Thank you very much for appearing on the program today.
Thank you, Raj. Thank you very much.
Until next time, keep reading, keep listening, and obviously, keep contemplating the mystery of the Devi. Take care.
Surely. Thank you very much. We'll be in touch.